You didn't get me a check?
No, just name, I don't know the title. Name, date, and title.
Okay. January 1, 2009, Rabbi Tzvi Simensky, brisket at a crossroads between Lumbus and postmodernism. Yes.
No, maybe I'll move up a little bit so we get to the center. Yeah. Just leave this on. I'm not sure if anyone here remembers the Cheshire Cat from Alice in Wonderland, one of the great figures in all of not only literature, but also in Disney movie history. The Cheshire Cat is basically, if you remember, is Alice in Alice in Wonderland. Remember, is Alice in Alice in Wonderland, I guess you could say, conscience, always there, always sort of visible, and then invisible, does the disappearing act, and there's that classic image where all that's left is the grin, the Cheshire Cat. And basically the role of this made up, right, it sort of doesn't really, there's no such thing as a Cheshire Cat, except in that movie, and a couple of other places, but the role of the Cheshire Cat is really to serve in many ways as Alice's conscience. And I've sort of over the years, I've had a similar feeling that like there was this conscience, there was this cat sitting over my shoulder as I've been learning for a number of years. I guess from way back, I guess in high school, really my roots in learning with the Brisker Derech. I was in KBC, I was in Rabbi Adler's year, and then I had Rabbi Jachter, and then I went to Eretz Yisrael, and I learned in Gush for a couple of years, so I learned in Rav Lichtenstein Shiurim, and then I came to Yeshiva University, and I attended Rav Michael Rosenzweig Shiurim, all of whom are known for their for having been either Talmidim of Rav Soloveitchik, or votaries of the Brisker Derech, really hardcore briskers, and I really had that education all the way through. And to this day, that's basically my Derech HaLimud, and I'll describe in some more clear detail what exactly the Brisker Derech is all about as part of an introduction. But basically, as I've gone on, I'll explain my dilemma, or the question that I've been grappling with, a little bit as we go along. But basically, I've had this sense, sort of over the course of the years that I've been learning, that there's something maybe a little bit wrong. Or at least, if not wrong, there are certain questions that I really should be thinking about, that are sort of implicit in the way that I learn, and my harusas all learn, and my rebbeim are learning, that hopefully will not, I don't think, really serve to undermine at all the this Derech HaLimud, but at the very least, I think can help us understand it better, to have a better appreciation for what is Brisker Lamdus, and what Rav Soloveitchik was doing, Rav Chaim Brisker were doing, and hopefully what we're doing nowadays as well. And hopefully through the analysis and understanding of what the Brisker Derech is really all about, hopefully we'll have a deeper appreciation for it and a clear understanding of what exactly it is that a Brisker Lamdan is really trying to do. Now just, as I said by way of introduction, I'd just like to take a step back and explain just a little bit more clearly what is the Brisker Derech, where does it come from, how has it developed over the years since it came into existence, what have been its challenges, what are its prospects for the future, what are its strengths, just what is, in short, what is Brisk really all about? If you think about it, you might be familiar, certainly most of everyone, nearly everyone is from Rina, certainly is familiar with to some extent, Rabbi Adler, certainly as the Talmud of the Rav, has to a large extent this Derech HaLimud. But basically, we're more or less familiar, but just to bring out some of the essential, characteristics of what Brisk is all about. The most important thing I would say, more than anything else about this new Derech HaLimud, which is really revolutionized by Rav Chaim Brisker more than anyone else a little over 100 years ago, is basically, the first and foremost, is to really bring out the conceptual underpinnings, to really ask what we call chakira, to ask critical questions about the nature of a particular phenomenon. And that could be about really anything in halacha. We'll see an example a little bit later on, just to throw out one example now, is, for example, we just had the holiday of Hanukkah. So Hanukkah, we have a mitzvah of hadlakas neros, so a classic brisket question, which really goes to the underpinnings, the roots of the mitzvah of hadlaka, is whether this is called a chovas hagavra or a chovas habayis. And the classic kind of brisk question, is this a chiyuv that lies upon every single individual? Every individual, qua individual, is obligated to light the menorah, to light the chanukiah. That's one possibility. Or the other possibility is to say that no, that really the mitzvah of hadlakas neros on Hanukkah is what we call a chovas habayis. It's not incumbent upon the individual. It rather is that the bias, the house as an institution or as a place, requires the menorah to be lit within it. And the mela, since the house can't really anticipate houses to go ahead and light menorahs, that would be a little bit complex. Although these days, pets are considered like teapot. I don't know, maybe houses do too. But certainly, right, that's one question. Maybe it's chovas habayis, and then the mela, it's incumbent upon every individual to fulfill the chiyuv that the house requires a lighting. And so on and so forth. Similar question by mezuzah. Is it an individual's obligation to place the menorah on each of the doorposts in the home? Or rather, do we say that it's a chovas habayis? And this is just one type, one mode of brisker chakira. This is similar to what we call the gavra versus chetza kind of question. But there are lots of similar questions, and we could easily multiply them. But that's really one crucial component of what brisk is really all about, is this an attempt to bring out the conceptual underpinning, the essential halachic questions about whatever halachic phenomenon is under discussion. That's one. Number two, and this is really part of Rav Chaim's revolution. It's very interesting. We take a look at Lamdos, basically, before Rav Chaim, and to a certain extent contemporaneously, there's a very different approach to the role of asking a question, raising a kasha, and offering an answer, giving a terutz. It used to be, once upon a time, that someone was learning. You're learning a particular halacha, learning a certain gemara, and you would ask a question on it, and all the achronim would ask kashas, or the rishonim already would ask questions, and they'd all try to bring out an answer. What's the answer to this particular question? And they would try to find an answer, and once they gave the answer, so that was it. We were satisfied. We had a question. The question has been resolved. There's nothing else to talk about. Right? That used to be the classical Derech HaLimud. But now with Brisk, with the advent of Rav Chaim, things really changed dramatically. Rav Chaim came along and said that no. Basically, he would ask questions, and he would give answers, but really the questions were more of a springboard toward the Lunda. See, that's the Kasha on the Rambam, and the answer wasn't just a way of being miyashev, of reconciling the view of the Rambam. Rather, it was a way of bringing out this critical idea, like we said, Chovas Habayis and so on, all these conceptual issues that Brisk was addressing. The questions were more a platform rather than a problem in their own right. So that, again, is interwoven with what we're talking about in terms of what Brisk is all about. The Rav in particular stressed that Brisk, more than any other Derech HaLimud, is almost, and I want to use this word in a positive way, is almost scientific. What did the Rav mean that Brisk is scientific? Right, so some, again, would use that in a more negative kind of way, right? It's a detract. Some would say, oh, it sounds like you're just being very scientific, like Torah is like, what? To the non-scientific. Oh, 100%, I agree. I'm saying one could imagine one thing, oh, that diminishes Torah and so on, but I think we're on the same boat here, that with the Rav certainly meant it as a compliment, that the Rav Chaim and this Derech transformed Lamdos into something that was more misudar, it was more well-organized, it had certain criteria. Like in science, there are certain legitimate questions, there are certain legitimate answers, there's a certain way of going about and properly trying to understand what a sugya is all about. And that sort of precision, that sort of methodological focus was unique to Brisk and really set it apart from all others. Also, in terms of the topic, what was the material that was learned? So classically, the Achronim would all learn what? They would learn Gemara, and they would learn Rashi Tosos and the Rambam, and all the different Rishonim, and there would be Shiurim. Achronim would give Shiurim on Achronim. It's very typical, even to this day, for Rosh Yeshiva to get up and give a Shiur Kwali, not on the Gemara, not on the Rambam, but on Rabbi Akiva Eger, one of the Achronim, who lived in the 19th century. Rav Chaim did away with all of that. Rav Chaim really focused on the Gemara, on Rashi and Tosos, but most of all, of course, on the Rambam. And we know that was one of the major contributions of Brisk. And finally, I say one other thing, is that Brisk really expanded the scope of what was learned in yeshivos. very interesting. If you take a look at the time of the if you go all the way back to the period of the Gaonim, before the Rishonim, so about the 800, 900s, 1000, all the way through, what were the topics that were traditionally learned? Two things. Number one, halacha l'maisa. That means, you know, Gemara's in Seder Moed, and Masechet Chulin, which has all of Hilchos Kashrus in it, and Masechet Nida, which is also Halacha L'maaseh. That was one part of what was learned. And, of course, Nashim Nezikin, right? All the classic Yeshivish and Masechet. So whether it's Baba, the Bavas, right? The Bakama Baba Mitzia and Baba Basra, whether that's Ksuvos, which is known in the Yeshivos as Shas Kata, and there's so much there in Ksuvos, and all the classical Yeshivish and Masechet. So Bris doesn't only learn that. Right, Rav Chaim started to focus more on all the other topics of learning that had been basically, to a large extent, abandoned, to the extent that they weren't practical. Seder's Ryan, right, outside of Brachos for a moment, right? But basically, whoever heard of someone giving shiurim on Maseches Demai, right? Between me and you, whoever heard of Maseches Demai, unless you have to learn for a siyum or something like that, right? And then Kadshim, certainly with the halachos of Karbanos, and Taros, also to a large extent. So, to a significant extent, the brisk really opened up the range of topics. They were really interested in a very broad range. In fact, I just saw someone, I was just actually visiting in Eretz Yisrael, and I was in Ramat Beit Shemesh for an Ufras, and I happened to be staying in the same house as someone who's learning in one of the brisker yeshivos in Yerushalayim. So I asked him, what are you learning? So he said, well, I'm learning Ksuvos this year. I said, wait a second, you're in a brisker yeshiva. They don't learn Ksuvos and brisker yeshivos. They learn Zvachim, and they learn Menachos, and they learn all the Kachim stuff and all the Tara stuff. He said, you're right, we're the only brisk yeshiva that actually learns the mainstream, you know, Nashim Nezikin stuff. He said, yeah, we're really out of the mainstream. So, you know, that was sort of very typical. And these are some of the real changes, the sea changes that briska brought about. And by the way, even halacha l'maaseh, you see this all the time. When a brisker has a certain hakpada or a chumrah, it's right, very often it will be based on some sort of conceptual idea, what is the nature of a particular halacha. So just for example, things that we might be familiar with, right? Some talmidim of the Rav have the hakpada to stand with their feet together throughout Chazaras HaShas. Why? Right, the Rav held that the Chazaras HaShas not just a repetition of the individual Shmon Esrei to fulfill the mitzvah for anyone who wasn't Yosei. The Rav held that it's Tfilas HaTzibor. It's a totally different kind of halacha. It's a Tfila of the Tzibor, and every individual is part of it, and therefore, said the Rav, it's a Tfilas HaTzibor, everyone has to be standing together. That's just one example. So the Rav had a certain conceptual understanding of what a halacha is all about, and that affected his practice, right? But it all comes from a certain underpinning, a certain conceptual idea. So another example, a lot of people have the minhag wearing a talis to perform atifa, to cover their heads. So if you take a look carefully, briskers are very machbed, and many others, most people I think, are machbed, even when they're covering their head, when they're wearing tefillin, they'll be very careful to cover all but the shel rosh. If you take a look carefully, you'll see even those who perform atifa, they leave the shel rosh exposed. You would have thought, if you really want to do a proper atifa, you should go all the way. You'll have more kavana and the sense of hashras, hashkina. So why would you leave the shel rosh uncovered? It's very strange. Anyone know the reason that we do that? Does someone do that? The reason is because the tefillin shel rosh, according to the Gemara, are really opposite. They're in the they're inverted. They're moving in the opposite direction, as it were, from the tefillin shel yad. Tefillin shel yad are for the individual. They're to inspire the individual a sense of yichud Hashem, a sense of binding one's own self to Kodesh Baruch Hu. That's the model of shel yad. The model of shel rosh is the opposite. The pasuk Gemara quotes the pasuk Ve'ra'u chol ameharet kishem Hashem nikra alecha. Tefillin shel rosh are called pe'er. They're something beautiful. They're meant to inspire others to see that which we represent. Tefillin shel rosh are about taking the idea of yichud Hashem, taking the idea of binding ourselves to Kodesh Baruch Hu and projecting that message outward. That's basically the idea of tefillin shel rosh. They're really moving again in that opposite direction toward the rest of the world. Therefore, say the briskers and many others nowadays as well, one should not cover the shel rosh. You shouldn't do atifa to block the shel rosh, because that's the whole idea. The whole point of the tefillin shel rosh is to project that message. Therefore, it would be inappropriate to cover the head, the shel rosh, with the talus as well. So again, here you have a particular practice that's based on a very profound, really conceptual understanding of what the halacha, the mitzvah tefillin shel rosh, is really all about. So again, it's very classic brisk in that sense, that even halacha l'maaseh practices, specific details, are ultimately going to be based in very profound ideas. So that's really the revolution of brisk. And I don't have time now, but another topic for another occasion might be, how has brisk developed over the years from Rav Chaim, and then you have his sons Rav Moshe Soloveitchik and Rav Velvo, and Rav Yitzchak Zev Soloveitchik, known as the Brisker Rav, who was a tremendous Gadol Hador in Yerushalayim. For many years, he was probably one of the top, I don't know, three Gedolei Hador of his time. Rav Velvo was really very well recognized. And then you have the Rav, Rav Moshe Soloveitchik's son, and of course others nowadays, and that would be a whole separate topic as well. Some of my Rebbeim, whom we'll be mentioning later as well, Rav Lichten, I mentioned before already, Rav Lichtenstein and Rav Michal Rosenzweig have also sort of charted their own paths in the Brisker Derech. So I'll just say very quickly, for example, Rav Lichtenstein has moved the Brisker Derech in a way that he's made it much more explicitly methodological. Rav Lichtenstein will give a shiur, he'll say, okay, when you have a Gemara like this, what do you want to do? So for example, the Gemara has a halacha that someone who's leaning is considered as if they're standing. So the Lichtenstein will say, well, what does it mean that someone who's leaning is considered as if they're standing? How do you understand the kaf? Right? What does it mean that you're, right? That you're ke omed, right? Ka mita. So the Lichtenstein will say, how do you understand the kaf? Every time you have a kaf that compares one phenomenon to another, you always have to ask yourself, does it mean to be a full equation? Does that mean that such a person is really considered to be standing in halacha for all the practical ramifications that would include? Or no, it means that for certain halachos, you don't really have to be standing. How do you understand the cup? So Rav Lichtenstein, that's just one example. And he'll tell you, he'll globalize it. Every time you see in halacha a comparison, X is like Y, you always have to ask yourself, what exactly does that mean? Okay, and so on and so forth. So Rav Lichtenstein has really, in his shiurim, he'll be explicit. He'll say, anytime you find this phenomenon, you should ask this. And it's a very methodological approach, and it's explicit about what the methodology is, which is, by the way, if you look at modern pedagogy, if you look, there's a lot of this about out there, right? Anyone who's read anything on educational literature knows that being explicit about how you do things and methodology is very important for students. That's what I'm seeing. Rosenzweig is really incredible in that he has tried to really, he's really tried to create a broad sort of sweep, and many have moved in this direction, to take specific chakiras, but see them as part of like a, what he calls a meta-halachic system. To take specific questions and see them as part of globally what is all halacha all about, and how do we understand what are the broader themes of halacha, what are the broader themes that animate Judaism. Incredible. You learn a Gemara, but you're not just learning a Gemara. You're learning shots, you're learning chakiras, but they're chakiras that go to the heart of what Judaism is all about. So on and so forth. Not time to give some examples, but this idea of creating systems of halakha, what we call meta-halakha, has been one of the major contributions of Rosenzweig. So the difference, the ways that Brisk has gone is a fascinating topic in its own right and gone for that for a long time. What I want to do at this point, though, is to just show, by way of example, some of the sources, and then to move more specifically to the problem at hand. Just some of the things we were talking about. If you take a look, the Rav has comments about the strength or the beauty of what Brisk has done. And the Rav wrote as follows, Torah scholars used to denigrate those who studied the laws of kashrus. Kosher laws. Only those who were about to enter the rabbinate would study this area of the law. In other words, it was just what? Halakha Maisa, which is very nice. You have to be a rabbi, you have to know how to paskin. But he said that used to be like an insult. You were just a postache. You weren't a real lamdan. Said the Rav, who would guess the day would come with the development of the Brisker approach and these laws would be freed from the bonds of facticity, external and common sense explanations, and become transformed into abstract concepts, logically connected ideas that would link together to form a unified system. Suddenly the pots and pans, the eggs and onions disappeared from the laws of meat and milk. The salt, blood, and the spit disappeared from the laws of salting. The laws of kashrut were taken out of the kitchen and removed to an ideal halakhic world, constructed out of complexes of abstract concepts. So that's the Rav. He's saying, basically, what did Brisk do? Brisk moved away from halakha maisa and elevated Lundus to this great platform, to this tremendous ideal construct. In Yoredeya, Hilchos Kashrus was transformed from a series of practical halakha questions to critical questions about the nature of halakha, about what Kashrus is all about. These critical halakha questions are, according to the Rav, what really glorifies Brisk and makes it so attractive to him. So that's, on one hand, that's one side of ledger. Of course, we're not surprised to see that the Rav is the one who gives the great applause for Brisk. He was part of that tradition, of course. However, on the other hand, just to take a counterexample, Rav Aryeh Karlin, who was a contemporary Rav at the time of Rav Chaim, had the following to say, which is a little bit of a different take. New times have come. numerous quote-unquote methods proliferate in the world of the Torah students. The halakha does not, however, follow a method. And this goes back to what Mark and I were discussing. Right? They lay claim to being pioneers and revolutionaries, the creators of the world of logical method in the study of the Torah. One must strongly protest against this. These methods have altered the whole face of halakhic studies. The Telzer method and the method of Chaim, which are now widespread in the yeshiva world, have done far more harm than good. The sages in years past did not content themselves with only the words of Maimonides and the Ravid, as is now customary in yeshiva. The Rosh Yeshiva teaches that only Maimonides and Ravid are the basis for logic in the Torah study of Torah, and all discussion concerns them. As if without Maimonides, there's no chidush in Torah, and there's no need to explain and elaborate the Talmudic opinions themselves and the contradictions in them, which are difficult to understand. So I think you see a lot of the different themes you were talking about. The Rambam and the Ravid, the fact that this is a new method, and it's that of Rav Chaim, the idea that at the very end, the point about elaborating the Talmudic opinions. That's what we said before about asking kashas and giving answers. He's saying, what, there's no point to asking a question and giving a good old-fashioned answer? That's what we've always been doing. And came along Rav Chaim and said, don't ask kashas just to give teirutim. You should ask questions to bring out the conceptual underpinnings of a particular idea. So I think that this harsh condemnation, or at least attack on this new quote unquote new Derech HaLimud, I think is very telling and goes to some of the things we were talking about. What harm? He doesn't really. I mean, this is like more of a. It's like a polemic a little bit. What?
What harm?
So.
No harm is that you're not learning the word anymore. You don't want to learn the word.
Right. So he thinks number one they're learning.
Losing the Yisrael.
What do you think? You don't know all the Achronim. You don't know. But you don't know the questions. You know the Achronim. You're just studying Gemara, Rambam, Ravid, and that's it. Right. That seems to be what he's getting at. What?
You're not a bucky,
right. I mean, look, it's very interesting. One of the misconceptions about Brisk is that all the Briskers only did Lamdas. Like they sat and asked hakiras all day and all these things. It's not true. It's not true. If you want to be a good lamb, then you have to know something. You can't just like, you know, oh, I have a hakira. Oh, excuse me, but your hakira is against about 10 explicit gemaras. Yeah, but it's a good question. It's a good question, you know? That's not how serious, yeah? If you're serious about halakha and you really care for it, that obviously doesn't work. I think Rav Schechter actually liked it, if I think I'm getting it right. Rav Schechter, I believe, tells a story that he used to try to test himself in terms of sas. He would take a question that Rav Moshe Feinstein addressed, and he would work through the sources, and Rav Schechter would arrive at his own conclusions, and then he would compare it to Rav Moshe's tshuva. It was like what Rav Schechter did for fun as a kid or something, you know. So I think Rav Schechter said that one time he had a whole mahalach and a whole tshuva, and he thought, this is really the right answer, it has to be, and then he opens up Rav Moshe's tshuva, and all Rav Moshe basically does is, in addition to whatever Rav Schechter quoted, he quoted a Mishnah in Kalim. So it's basically, it's a Mishnah Mifurashas, it's explicit, so that's the halacha, that's it. So, that was the end of that. So Rav Schechter said, you see from here, that you can do all the longest you want in the world, you can ask all the great chakiras, but if you don't know the Mishnah in Kalim, you're not necessarily fully qualified to give a psak halacha on that level, and you have to recognize that there's a certain nikiyas that is a prerequisite to proper learning. How much and how that works is a separate question, but it's certainly an important idea to keep in mind. Okay. Now, just to move a little bit closer to what I really want to get at in terms of this, what I was saying, the Cheshire Cat, what was really bothering me for these years. So there are a number, I think we already mentioned them, some strengths of the Brisker Derech, and we could elaborate that. And there are perhaps some challenges or weaknesses, but what I really want to go is to the heart of the matter. And I called the topic of the Shiur Brisk at a crossroads between Lamdas and postmodernism. What I mean Brisk at a crossroads is basically that as the years have gone on, and we're a little over the 100-year mark in terms of the Brisker Derech and its development, there seems to be a nagging question. A basic problem that I think needs to be addressed, and I think it's a critical question, about what the Brisker Derech is trying to do, and it's, I think, a critical methodological question about what Brisk is doing. For example, let's take a look at the Rambam in source number 3, and this I'll just use to start to elaborate the issue, and we'll take it from there. The Rambam has a psak in Hilchos Nizkei Mammon about Hilchos Shomer. The Rambam writes as follows, HaMoza Behemto Shomer Chinam Alunot Yisachar O L'Socher O L'Shoel. So let's say someone takes his animal, and he gives it to a shomer chinam, nosei sachar, socher, shoel, all the different kinds of shomrim. So that's someone who's guarding it, someone who's being paid to guard it, or someone who's paying to use it, all sorts of all the four different permutations of shomrim. So writes the Rambam, nichnusu tachas habaylan. The shomer stands in place, he literally steps into the place of the owner of the animal, the imhizika, Hashomer Chayav. And if that animal that the shomer now has responsibility for, if it damages another animal or someone else's property, the shomer, the guard, is obligated to pay for the damages. However, writes the Rambam, he qualifies. That is only true if the watchman, if the guard, does not guard the animal at all. If he guards it properly, fully, karaoi, as he is supposed to, the yatsas v'hizika on the animal nevertheless went out and caused damage, hashomrim p'turim, v'havaylim chayav, and afilu misa es ha'adam. Writes the Rambam that in such a case, the shomer is exempt. Why? Because he performs his responsibility. He guarded the animal as he was supposed to. So the shomer is potter, but the Rambam very surprisingly writes, v'havaylim chayav. Why is that strange? I don't understand. I'm legitimately permitted to go ahead and take my animal to lend it to whomever I want. Once the shomer takes it, the Rambam wrote himself, Nichnesu tachas habayla. Who's responsible now? That's the shomer. Is that legitimate? Is that reasonable? Absolutely. That's the halacha of shmira. Upon whom does the chi of shmira devolve? The shomer. So I understand the shomer's pater. Why? Because he did his job. He watched it as best he could. But why, asks everyone on the Rambam, what is the Rambam talking about that the Bailim are Chayav? And not only that, but if you jump over to the next side, the Shulchan Aruch basically in source number 5 passes the Salacha of the Rambam. Right? So the Mechaber, Masro le'echad me'arba'a shomrim, he hands it over to one of the four shomrim, v'im shmarua karaoi shmira me'ula, ha'shomrim turim, v'ha'bailim chayavim. Said Rav, so the Mechaber basically passes the Salacha that the shomer is exempt, but the Baal is going to be Chayav to pay back. And on this basis, the Ravid, I didn't put it on the sheet, so I didn't want to get too sidetracked with this, but the Ravid has a certain comments on the Rambam, and Rav Chaim, in his Chidushi Rav Chaim al HaRambam, on this Rambam, based on this Rambam, with the comments of the Ravid, Chaim has a whole discussion, he links this to the nature of the Chiyuv Shmira of a Shomer, and he has a whole Lamdish piece, I think what they call a Ma'aracha, is a whole analysis of this particular sheet of the Rambam. There's one problem. Problem is, the Rambam. What are you, the problems of the Rambam? We just read the Rambam. There's another Rambam, a little bit later on, and that's quoted in source number 4, the Ketz of Mishnah. Right, the Ketz of Mishnah, Hamoseh b'amtol shem rechinam v'chulal, shman ruav shimirav chusa, etc. You can skip, he says in this middle of the second line, tachi anuska shebiyadinu. That's the nusach, in other words, with the words that the shomer is exempt at the Bailim Archayim. Right? So, right, the Ketz of Mishnah, the Chachmei Luniel Shalu Mirabinu, in the Chachmei Luniel of Provence, southern France, they wrote a whole series of questions to the Rambam. I think there are 24 or so that are printed. And the Chachmei Luniel asked him, Al Mazeh HaBailim Chayavin. Why should the Baal be Chayav in this case? As we said, the Shomer did his job, so what went wrong? V'heshiv Lahem Shetaos Soferhu. So that's very funny. So the Rambam writes, that's all solving a mistake. The Kachi Anusra Hamitis, and he says, this is the correct answer of the Rambam, the Yatsa V'Yizika, right, just skips to go to the next side. If the animal went out and caused damage, Hashomrim Surim, Shamru Shirab Chusa, in Shomrachinim, who Pater, V'Habailim Chayavim, etc., etc. But basically, again, the details are not so crucial for our purposes, but basically, in terms of this line, Shmira Mu'ula, the Bailim Chayavim, the whole thing was wrong, the Rabbi doesn't get off the ground, the Chayim doesn't get off the ground, the whole thing is like, you know, it's just Basel, and by the way, right, source number 5, now that we're on the second page, right, Shulchan Aruch, it turns out, is based on what the Rambam himself wrote in a later tshuva, an incorrect girsa in the Rambam, which is its own discussion. It's really a Pandora's box about Psak Halacha. What happens when a Psak Halacha has been accepted for 500 years, but was based on a wrong girsa? Or what happens if Psak Halacha has been the same way for 500 years, but we then dug up another tshuva of the Rambam, which says the opposite. So what do we do? What? You find the meter in the Gemiza. What do you do with the meter? That's a whole other discussion, which is a fascinating issue in its own right. So that's you can say oops. You can say that's it. Okay. It's interesting. Just an aside. One of the cases this came up, not with the Meiria, but with the Rambam, is the issue, actually, interestingly enough, of standing during Kriyas HaTorah for certain parts of the laning. Especially for what? Anyone know? The same true for the Rambam? What? For Aseret HaDibros, right. For centuries and centuries, what was the minhag? Always? Yeah. To stand, right? Specifically, everyone would sit for all the Kriyas HaTorah, they would specifically stand for Aseret HaDibros, and then, I think it was in the Gemiza, they discovered this tshuva of the Rambam that said that it's absolutely usher to stand up during Aseret HaDibros, you can't do it, the Minim will think that one part of Torah is more important than the other ones, it's absolutely horrific, and someone asked me and I told them that if they know what they're talking about, they'll be Vatel, the Minog, and they're shul, like none of this is the Rambam. So what do we do? Right? And by the way, the Beis Yosef passed in one way, but the Beis Yosef didn't have the tshuva of the Rambam. So what would the Beis Yosef have done? So what should we do? So this is a whole big... You read it twice. You read it twice. That's where I'm always, just like that's where my mother came from also. It sounds a different case, so very good. So that's the... they make two minyanim on him. That's what they do. Okay, so these are real questions. But the Psak Halacha issue aside, this raises a certain question about Brisker Lundus. What happens when you have a Brisker idea, but the problem is, it's the wrong Girsa? So is that Torah legitimate? Rav Chaim said it, based on the right that Rav Chaim had his idea, and everyone, all of the other Achornim probably got up and had a whole discussion. Are all those discussions, are they Bittel Torah? Are they Talmud Torah? Should we learn them? Isn't that part of the Torah corpus? Right? Isn't that also part of what we call Elu Be'elu Divri Elokim Chayim? It's also part of Torah. Or do we say, no, it's all a big mistake. Forget about it. Don't waste your time. So that's one question. But it gets more interesting or more subtle. What about different type of question? What about, even when we have the right girsa, let's say a Lamban comes along and sees a problem in the Rambam. And the Lamban gives a particular explanation. But what's the problem? Sometimes you have to wonder, who is really giving this explanation? Is it the Lamban? Is it the Brisker? Right? Or is it really, right? Is it the Rambam? Or is it really just the Lamban? Or does it matter? Right? When do we say, or how do we deal with the problem? Sometimes the explanations, the approach that we can suggest for the Rambam wasn't necessarily what the Rambam himself had in mind. Or at least we don't know. We can guess, right? Don't forget, when did Brisker Lundus start in, at least in the current form? 100 years ago. The Rambam, believe it or not, lived a little bit before that. The Rambam, right, contrary to popular belief, was really not a Brisker after all. So, maybe the next time I give the shiur, that's what I should call it. It was the Rambam of Brisker. That would have been good. But, anyhow, so that's really a critical question. So I just, yes, please.
I'll follow this question, especially the first one.
Yeah.
Yes,
the first question, yeah, for sure, 100%, again. Really, I just want to use this to focus on the second one. I think the second one is particularly problematic, because if you're just asking a kasha and giving an answer, so I think it's more likely to say, the Rambam thought in that way as well. But if you have the specific, unique ideas or characteristics of the Brisker Derech, I think that's more of a challenge for Brisker in particular. But certainly in terms of the Gersaos issue, I think your point is well taken. Yes?
Formulating those questions.
Yes.
Really comes under the same heading. Mm-hmm. Why do you bring Rabbi Yehuda's opinion if we possibly Rabbi Meir? Once the Mishnah establishes this notion of conceptual analysis, which has to be what you're talking about if you permit unfollowed opinions.
Right. So
it seems to me the whole attack falls apart.
I think it's a good question, but I think that there's a difference. I'll tell you what that is. The difference is that if you would go to Rabbi Yehuda and ask him, let's say it was a machlokes Rabbi Yehuda, Rabbi Meir, and let's say we pass him like Rabbi Meir in that particular opinion. Okay? So if you go to Rabbi Yehuda now and ask him, what is your opinion about this topic? What would Rabbi Yehuda say? He would say, that's still my opinion. I held of it. You may choose not to postulate like it, but that's my opinion.
As you said, Rabbi Yehuda would be very careful to differentiate between what do I think or what's the halakha l'maaseh.
Okay.
Fine,
so that's what Rabbi Yehuda would find. So let's say that's what Rabbi Yehuda would say. But here, let's say it's the wrong here. So then for sure, if you go to the Rambam, and the Chachmi Elinil did in the Shuvah, they said, what do you think, Rambam? And you say, I never said anything like that in the first place. It was all copyists.
But when you say, what do you think, that disguises.
What's your shita? What's your opinion? What's your psychology?
What's your opinion as a concept, or what's your opinion of
Lama? That's what I'm saying. Here it's much more dramatic, because here, again, if you go to Rabbi Yehuda and ask him, he would say the same thing. The Rambam would deny the whole thing. He would say it never said in the first place. I think it's very different. And even on the other point, again, if you go to the Rambam and say, the Rambam, did you say this Lamdos or did you not say this Lamdos? The Rambam would say, what's Lamdos? What are you talking about? All right, that's the old story for Chaim Metta. That's all.
The Rambam would agree, and I think you'll agree with what I'm about to say.
Go ahead.
The Rambam would agree with, I never said that because that's not what I wrote.
Right.
But how did the Ritzik and Tirsa, this would have been the concept of the past one.
That's true, but the question is, if it's all the wrong Tirsa, is it still Torah? It was all a mistake.
Yes, it's still Torah.
You think it's your thing? I totally hear that.
It is part of the concept.
Okay, so you definitely, I mean, you can explain that. So you could definitely make that argument, but others would respond that no, it was all a big mistake. And it's very different than Rabbi Yehuda, because Rabbi Yehuda wasn't a mistake at all. And this is all just based on a wrong gear, son. Good debate for you. It's just 1 second. People have their hands up.
On the second question.
Yeah.
I mean, the risk of lumps comes out of some problem. I get a shrer Rambam. You don't understand the Rambam because it appears to contradict another Rambam.
Right.
And then the brisket comes up with some conceptual analysis. And I mean, I've often had the sense when I've heard that. That's brilliant, But he said that the Rambam thought that. But the Rambam had to think something.
Right.
So if you go back to the Rambam, he might say, no, that's very interesting, but I didn't think of it.
Right.
But he'd have to say something. He'd have to explain the Shver Rambam.
Right.
Some way or another.
100%.
So maybe he'd come up with a different rule.
Right. But the question is,
it has to be something.
That's the question, though. If the Rambam had a different analysis, right, or so then the question is, so what are we learning? That's really the question. Are we learning the Rambam at that point? Are we learning ourselves? What exactly are we doing? Just to be honest about, if we're engaged in this, if I've been learning for X amount of years, and you know, we want to be honest and try to understand what it is that we're trying to do, and to really to make sure learning to a large extent is to trying to do our best to navigate to find the truth. So we want to know what exactly the truth is, or what exactly we're doing when we're seeking for it.
Regarding the Gita issue,
yeah.
I think at least in the times of Gemara, people were more comfortable saying, No, you really have to say it this way. And then just move the conversation out. Right? The Gemara frequently would say, this Mishnah...
Mishabeshta here.
Right, it doesn't make sense. There's two things. No, really, you should learn it this way.
Right.
And then they just change the gears right there. Right.
Or more
right. That's all right. Exactly. Well, to move to figure out what the truth
is.
But we still learn. We still learn the fact that this was misprinted and that this was whatever, right? And the same thing here. You have to get the Mishnah,
right.
Okay, that was misprinted and
have
it, whatever.
Right.
That's part of the whole thing.
Right. So the question is, would you give like a shir klali in your Rosh Yeshiva? Mazel tov. So you're giving a shir klali on this halakha, right? So the question is, do you build a whole approach based on this Rambam, or do you make that a centerpiece of the shir? Or do you say there's this gear, so the Rambam? Ruchaim tried to explain it. Truth is, it doesn't really seem to pan out.
That would be okay.
You're saying it would be okay.
It would be okay to have...
You're holding like
what happened? How about as the Mishnah even made it all the way into the Shulchan Aruch, right?
Right.
Bring a whole thing and say, okay, now we have to kind of figure out what to do with it.
Right, okay.
People are very, things have kind of stagnated a little bit in the sense that you really think what to be on paper is something, like unchanging,
interesting.
Physics kind of thing.
Uh-huh, very interesting. That's interesting. Well, I think Dr. Zitter was suggesting also it may have to do with the developments in the academic community in terms of people being very wary about those kinds of things.
Right.
When Dikduke Sofrim with all the Gersos was originally published, all the Gedolei Hador were very happy about it. So Zuchensee makes this point in one article. And now, if you get off, go over the shelf and you take out the Dikduke Sofrim, it's like, you're going to have a hard time finding a shidduch. So, so it's interesting. Yeah, I think your point is well taken. Yeah, sorry.
Yeah, so... The thing is, your point was about that you build a whole edifice on top of two Rambams against each other or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Turns out they're not really, then the whole edifice crumbles.
Right.
It's not just a simple problem of if it's taking kosher or not.
Right.
It's the whole yadu that's potentially falling down on your shoulders.
Right.
And you see some of that in the Gemara also, because that's why they'll go through it. Saying, so-and-so said this, and he said that, what did this guy do with that pasuk, what did that guy do with that pasuk, and go through, because they have built a bit of an edifice on top of the structure, so the more significant the issue, the more you'll see that they'll work these things out also. Even if they compliment the Mishabeshna or something like that, you still have to work it all out, because it's not just that little issue, it's a bigger issue involved.
100%. Point well taken. 100%. Okay. So the question is, though, how exactly do we deal with this, and have we seen also traditional formulations of this, I guess, this restraint or this concern about the Derech of Rav Chaim in particular? So it's interesting, interestingly enough, take a look at source number 6. I bumped into one. And this is from none other than the Sri D.H. So we're doing pretty well for ourselves. This is really one of the Gedolei Hador in pre-war and post-war Europe. And the Sri D.H., he wrote things other than his Tshuva about Kalisha, believe it or not. He had other things to say, too. So Sri D.H. wrote as follows. While the ideas of Rav Chaim Soloveitchik are true from the standpoint of profound analysis, they are not always so from a historical standpoint. This is the Sri D.H., very interesting. That is, with regard to the true meaning of Maimonides, whose way of study was different than that of Rav Chaim Soloveitchik. This does not detract. But now it takes the turn. Look at this. This does not detract from the value of this intellectual genius, who is worthy of being called a new Rambam, but not always as an interpreter of Maimonides. Yet Rav Chaim, by way of his brilliance, arrived at the same conclusions Maimonides reached through a different method of study. Fascinating. So you're saying on one hand, right, he's having his cake and eating it too. On one hand, Rav Chaim sometimes was not talking about the Rambam. He thought he was, but not necessarily. He's talking about Rav Chaim. He says, but it's Rav Chaim. Rav Chaim is like a new Rambam, right? It's, Rav Chaim is worth studying in his own right. So that might be one of the answers to some of these problems is, well, the Rambam may not have said it, but Rav Chaim did. And if Rav Chaim thought it was compelling, then that's worth something in its own right. And he might respond and say, well, Rav Chaim wouldn't have said it if he didn't think the Rambam said it, but the Rambam didn't say it if he had the wrong girsa or something like that. But you could respond that the fact that Rav Chaim took all this this intellectual energy and he really put it in, he really developed the idea and took it in other directions as well, sounds like Rav Chaim himself had a certain conviction about this idea in many cases. So this is part of the issue, but certainly the fact that the Sri Yesh is so sensitive to this topic I think is very interesting and goes to the heart of what we're talking about. Now what? Yes?
I always had trouble trying to understand what he's talking about. If Rav Chaim was not a parish from the Rambam, but was a parish from the Gemara, and he wound up coming to the same conclusion as the Rambam did, I can understand what the Sri D.H. is talking about. But essentially what Rav Chaim is a parish on the Rambam. He's explaining what the Rambam did. Why did the Rambam formulate this way, and he didn't formulate that way? Mm-hmm. His way of thinking is so fundamentally different than the Rambam. Then this whole idea of Rav Chaim being a new Rambam just doesn't seem to make sense. If it was a parish under Gemara, I understand.
Right.
But if it's a parish under Rambam, and the methodology at least seems to be historically inaccurate, then I don't understand what the Sri D.H. is talking about.
So I would just say, this is not what the Sri D.H. is saying, is that I think it depends on the case. And if we had more time, I'd bring some examples of classic Risker Lundus that to me are really very compelling. There are a lot of cases that I think really are on merits, really do make a lot of sense. And I think it depends on the chakira involved. And that's one point, and it's not all or nothing. We have to take every case in its own right and really consider it, and, you know, this is a compelling explanation with the historicity and looking at it through that lens also, but in the end of the day, sometimes I think it really is compelling. Now in terms of the Sri D.H. though, I think you're right. I mean, he's not saying that, he's granting that. He's saying, in certain cases at least, Rav Chaim is not a compelling reading of the Rambam, but all the Sri D.H. is saying is just that he's a new Rambam in the sense that Rav Chaim is a tremendous Gaon in his own right. And if Rav Chaim has thought that this idea is a compelling halachic idea, given his halachic intuition, given his deep and wide-ranging understanding of the halachic system, then the fact that this is the Shita of Rav Chaim stands on its own right. I think that's what he's saying. But you're right. I think it is still a critique of it's still granting that it's not always an explanation of the Rambam.
So as you're saying, yes, halachic intuition, but the methodology to which he gets the answer
is partially
right. The problem with that.
That's
what people learn, nobody learns his intuition. His intuition is something that's private to him. But
right.
People learn his methodology, mm-hmm. logical methodology of getting to the answer.
Right.
Which means that what people are learning in Rav Chaim mm-hmm. is a part of Rav Chaim that according to the Sri D.H. is wrong.
Right. I think it's a fair point, and I think maybe the Sri D.H. would also add that it depends. In other words, if it's only based on the Rambam, it's one thing. If it's the Rambam, but it's also this Tosos, and it's this Gemara, and it's with another body of evidence, so then the fact that it's based on another body of evidence, and maybe I think intuition is still relevant, but not maybe standing on its own together with the other body of evidence. So then maybe the Shridesh would be even more inclined to say what he's saying, which is that Rav Chaim stands on his own two legs. But maybe if it's only the Rambam, I think that then there might be a little more room for caution. So I think that we grant that. I think it's a fair point.
Do we know how Rav Chaim or the Rav utilized this methodology? In other words, did they, in practical terms, in real life, did they start with the Rambam, oh, I have this problem, let me get an answer? Or did they come up with this brilliant idea, wow, maybe it's such and such, and then fit it into the Rambam?
It's an interesting question. I think your guess is as good as mine.
Okay,
I don't know if that
refers. Did they say anything, or do any of the Talmidim discuss this at all?
I don't.
I'm thinking more of the Rav than the Rambam than the Chaim, because the Rav.
Well, right. What I would say is that Briskers in general, maybe this is what you're just alluding to at the end, that final point that the Rav might be different. Briskers in general, I think, are not as explicitly reflective about what they do. As part of what Rav Chaim was doing, is I'm just here to learn. They weren't. That's why we're here. In other words, right, Rav Chaim doesn't tell you what he's trying to do. And his Talmidim generally aren't reflective or transparent in that sort of way. So to a certain extent, your guess is as good as mine. I would say, though, someone who's a little bit more modern might be more, someone who's, you know, has a university education and so on, might be a little more inclined to be self-reflective in that way and even explicit about that reflectiveness. So we haven't found anything yet, but I think it may depend on the case. I mean, sometimes there's an idea and sometimes it's the other way, and sometimes it's just the two go together. It's almost like they play off one another. This idea, then the Rambam, and then this clicks and that clicks, and back and forth, and the whole dynamic process, and ultimately leads the idea. But that's just a guess.
It's not a science model like that. It doesn't matter what your motivation was. Either you can't permission.
Right. Correct or it's not.
You said this what sounds like, and I think it's promoted by, you'll see it walk from the Brisker methodology. I think there are people walking around with the idea that there's an algorithm. You walk into the base metric, you pick up the check sheet, check this note. That's not how people think. I don't think that's our kind of thought.
Right.
None of them are thought.
Right.
It's just a matter of once the position is there, what does it stand for?
Mm-hmm.
And that's what enables you to do all these things.
Mm-hmm.
It's an algorithm.
Right.
Which obviates the question you're asking him, how organized is it in the sense of that he consults a manual before he comes over the floor.
Right. But it still needs to be rigorous in the sense that it needs
no,
to
no.
be... Right, so the question is how exactly... So the question is how do you draw that balance if it's not going to be... If there's no one right scientific method for Gemara learning, and at the same time, as I said, we want it to be rigorous, we want it to be based on the sources, so how exactly do we draw that balance? That's what I was bringing intuition in earlier as well. It is a human process. We're not supposed to be computers, but... You know, part of this issue is, well, if it's not based on the Rambam, the evidence is faulty, so then what do you do? It's still significant even if we're not perfect, and even if we're not computers. It's definitely part of the equation, but it's a part of the equation. The question is, what do you do? Okay. What I'd like to do is to take the last few minutes and suggest, this is really just in broad strokes, three possible approaches to grappling with these problems, three suggestions. The first two are of Meribayim, one is Rav Rosenzweig, one is Rav Lichtenstein. I haven't really discussed it, at least not recently, with them, although I probably should, at least Rav Rosenzweig, who's accessible these days in NYU, but... and I'll add a suggestion of my own, a modest one, and something I've been working on, but something I think still needs more work. So I'd love to hear what everyone, the esteemed crowd, has to say as well. Rosenzweig, I think, is one end of the spectrum, one end of the ledger. Rosenzweig basically says, you have great questions, but they're simply wrong. Lumbus is true, or in many cases, we can say this is what the Rishonim thought, this is what the Rambam thought. And you may have certain questions. You may be surprised by that. You may have certain historical questions about that assertion. But in the end of the day, it's really true. And Rosenzweig makes a couple of points. Number one, not on the sheet, Rosenzweig basically says, very often, an idea may not be consciously or explicitly mentioned by a Rishon, but often it's there, at least subconsciously, or it's there, it's underneath the surface. Sometimes they'll try to bring it out. They'll try to show you how it's there. He would even say that if you look at the Gemara, sometimes the Gemara sounds very lumbish. So going back to Habakkuk Sneros, the Gemara has a Chakira. We mentioned the Chakira, whether Habakkuk Sneros is a Chovas HaGavra or a Chovas HaBayis. So the Gemara has another Chakira. The Gemara says, right, Hanacha Usei Mitzvah or hadlaka osa mitzvah? Is it the act of placing it there, or is it the act of lighting? Sounds pretty lumdish to me. And you could multiply this. There are mesechtos that actually sound pretty lumdish. Mesechtos krisos in kudshim, not so often learned because it does have the kudshim tag attached to it, and it's hard. But mesechtos krisos actually reads like sometimes, at least some briskers have claimed that it reads almost like brisker lumdus. Some have at least made that suggestion. I think we wrote something much in that one place. So, number one, it's really there. There are roots for it in the Gemara. There are roots for it in the Rishonim. The Rishonim don't say it explicitly. They're often thinking it implicitly. It may be there between the surface and beneath the surface. You learn enough Rishonim, you see that they're really operating with these ideas, so on and so forth. That's number one. Beyond that, Rosenzweig writes as follows. This is a fairly recently published book as part of the Orthodox Forum series. They have these topics. They get together, sponsored by Yeshiva University, to discuss every year. And a number of years ago, they had one on the conceptual approach to learning, basically on lumdus. And that was the general topic. And Rosenzweig wrote a paper for that conference, and it's published. It's actually online. I think you can find it through yutorah.org, I believe. And in that article, Rosenzweig discusses the strengths and weaknesses. He writes, "One should be particularly sensitive to the dual charge that this approach is more likely than others to introduce extraneous individual sensibilities," which is basically what we're saying, right? Our ideas, not those of the Rambam, or theories, into the halakhic process, number one, and that it implies and inspires insufficient ira, number two, which we haven't mentioned, that some said, oh, it's so scientific, so then where does the Torah relate to our humility? And sometimes the brisker who thinks he has all these grandiose ideas sometimes can, God forbid, become swept up in that. That's just one of the claims that can be rejected, can be challenged, but that's one of the claims that's been aimed at the brisker there. In this respect, many of the critics have overlooked an important dimension of brisker thought, which at least in theory, mostly neutralizes these arguments. A critical feature of the brisker outlook is the notion that halakhic thought constitutes an inner logic, one which need not cohere with and certainly does not require the validation of other systems or modes of thinking. This perspective is, of course, fully consistent with the view that halakha constitutes a divine blueprint and is both a priori and ideal. In order to create within the halakhic system, one must first submit to its overriding authority and subordinate one's own sensibilities to its inner logic. The ideal halakhic man of brisk is an individual whose very personality has been shaped by the categories and sensibilities of Torah. His sole motivation in the pursuit of halakhic truth, which is necessarily also informed by his own halakhic insights, is to further identify, clarify, and advance these categories and values. This perspective powerfully projects the theme of Yirato Kodemet L'Chokhmato, the priority of reverence over wisdom, as it entails a surrender of heart and mind to the halakhic process and to its categories. It is surely no coincidence that the towering intellectual giants of Brisk have also been acknowledged as giants of Yirat Shemayim, whose ethical, moral, and pietistic standards serve as inspirational models. What is Rosenzweig talking about? What's he saying? Anyone want to...
Bahag Anokhi.
Bahag on Anokhi. What's that?
Does that need clarification?
Commitment to the system. Okay, fine. Very good. In other words, the Bahag doesn't count a mitzvah. The Bahag is one of the monia mitzvahs who does not count a mitzvah of belief in the existence of God. And the general explanation for that is the Bahag maintain that belief in the existence of Kadosh Baruch Hu, emun, that basic cardinal principle of emunah, is not one of the mitzvot, it is a prerequisite, it is the foundation for all the mitzvot, and therefore it cannot be counted. And they're saying as well, Rosenzweig is saying that basically that halacha has a certain internal logic to it, it has a system, and basically our goal, or our the first step is to submit ourselves to that system. Like we have to submit ourselves to the existence of the Baruch Hu, so too, here we have to submit ourselves to the inner logic of halacha, and that is exactly what lumdus is. That's certainly one piece. To elaborate that a little more fully, Rosenzweig seems to be saying that basically, brisker lumdus is anything but an external projection of our ideas onto the Gemara, onto the Rambam. It's just the opposite. The halachic man attempts to, halachic man of brisk, attempts to basically to identify or to bring out the underlying or internal logic, the system of halacha, that is its own system. Right? We know that the halacha predates the Torah. We know predates the existence of the world. Right? Midrash says like 2,000 years. So the Torah predates the existence of the universe. And therefore, What we're trying to do is to understand or to really submit ourselves to the internal logic of what halacha is. Therefore, says Rosenzweig, not only are we not imposing our ideas onto the Rambam, we're actually extracting the ideas of the Rambam from the halachic text. Moreover, if anything, it will lead to anything but arrogance. Properly understood, halachic study will actually lead us to reverence, to humility. Why? Not taking our ideas and putting them on the Rambam. We're submitting ourselves to the internal logic of halacha. So at least if a person learns properly, lungs should lead one to a profound sense of humility as well. I see a puzzled face. Yes?
That seems to be saying that there's only one methodology in halakha, and that methodology is the Bris. How can you say anything else? Come on. Aren't we all Briskers?
We're all not right. Not all of us are Briskers yet.
If you can take this idea of a pre-existing halakhic framework, it's one thing to say that for the horizon, but once you try to start taking that idea and, you know, building. Attaching to it, even notions that there are opponents to that, I think insurmountable.
It's
the physics is one thing.
I'm going to respond along those lines.
Two is the very nature, and this is an exceptional upright also.
Yeah.
Is the halakha like Beis Hillel, because the road, or this seems to have this requirement. Right.
So now, okay, now.
There's a truth out there, and it has to be reclassified based on halacha, because otherwise it wouldn't be a limited truth, which...
Well, Pesach Halacha may be aside, and Pesach Halacha we might say is not necessarily the only truth. That's what we say, Elu V'Elu Devei Elokim Chayim, but Pesach Halacha is about how do we find the practice, we have to live as halachic Jews, so how do we go about that? But 100%. I'm probably running late. Am I running late? So no one has to go anywhere. I don't want to hold people for too long, but I want to, I do want to say that I think these are both, important comments, and I think that they're both important issues that have to address. The idea that the parallel to physics might help over here a little bit. In other words, physics, as other systems of science, has certain laws, and there really is only one set of laws of physics. You either have the right law of physics, or it's not the right law of physics. And the same can be said for cosmology and lots of other areas of human thought. It's interesting, because I think Rosenzweig majored in physics in the Yeshiva College. Maybe that's part of the, I don't know what's going on here, I don't know. But I think that might be a response, and I think this issue is a major issue, which I think needs more elaboration. I'm happy to continue the conversation afterward as well. In terms of the Rabbanan issue, I think it's also a question. I think Rosenzweig would respond that Chazal, because of their having been also halakhic men, he would say that they were presumably in tune with the internal logic, even more so than we are. If we strive to be, they certainly were even more in tune. They were closer by a long time to Sinai, but more than that, they had more familiarity, they had more wisdom, and therefore they were even more in tune with the halakhic ideas. So the Durabanans are not like some human, they're also not just sort of a projection, but that comes from their halakhic understanding. I'm not necessarily advocating. I'm just devil's advocate. No, but again, I'm happy to continue. I just want to mention two other approaches. The second approach overall is that of Rav Lichtenstein. Rav Lichtenstein basically takes the opposite approach. And I didn't put it on the sheet. Rav Lichtenstein has actually bought it here. I'm selling it afterward for just not for discounted price. So okay, we have it on the wall already. Leave the Faith. This is Volume 1, and this is subtitled The World of Jewish Learning. And Lichtenstein actually published here a speech that was originally delivered at the Bernard Revel Graduate School at YU, and it's entitled Chapter 3, entitled Torah Chesed and Torah Emet. Torah Chesed, Torah Emet. And Lichtenstein basically develops the idea that, and it's a fascinating idea, and I think it's a very debatable idea, that there are two parts or two aspects to Talmud Torah. One is what he calls the true Torah, Torah of truth, Torah Emet, and that's basically the intent of the Rambam, the intent of the Rishon. That's one mode of learning, and that's also perhaps the mode of Pesach Halacha as well. But then there's another mode, which he based on, I think, a very expansive explanation or idea, notion of Elu ve'elu divrei Elokim chayim. To view halacha and learning is more supple, is more flexible, as more subject to the subjective understanding of the lamdan. And that, basically, as he says, that's Torah's chesed. And Rechinami, maybe Rav Chaim wasn't saying shat in the Rambam. Maybe that's not what the Rambam historically had in mind at all. But at least on the level of Torah emet, there's a certain significance or a certain stature to that as well. That's basically Lichtenstein's thesis. And the way that he defends Brisker Lundus is basically by saying, as the total opposite is of Rosenzweig. Rosenzweig is saying, that's really what the Rambam had in mind. That's really what the Gemara had in mind. You just have to submit yourself to the halachic system and understand what the Amoraim and what the Rishonim were really trying to get at. That's what Rosenzweig. Rosenzweig says that no, that that's one part of learning, true, but there's a second part, and that's Brisker Lundus, which is not necessarily what did the Rambam say. That's what's my best understanding of the Rambam. Maybe that's not what the Rambam had in mind. But given the tools that are available to me in 2009, how can I best understand the Rambam without necessarily asking ourselves what did the Rambam himself had in mind? Or another way of saying it, he says, is that the text of Mishneh Torah takes on a status in its own right. And that's very much a postmodern kind of idea, if you think about it. Basically, there's the objective intent of the historical intent of the author, and then there's the subjective significance of the text which goes beyond that. This is a major theme in literary theory, since the French discussed this very broadly in the 19th century. It's all a big discussion, but basically that's the Lichtenstein's idea, which I hope it's clear that that's in many ways the polar opposite of one of his Talmidim and Chachamim, interestingly enough, of that of Rav Rosenzweig. And you can take a look. It's a very interesting article, and it's on the shelf apparently, so feel free to take a look at it. But that's basically, in a word, the approach of Rav Lichtenstein. I just wanted to suggest something on my own, and I think it requires a lot more thought, and I hope it's clear, but I did want to mention it, which is that it could be that you don't have to say either of these ideas. It could be you don't have to be postmodern, take the postmodern idea like Rav Lichtenstein, that's what I call between Lundus and postmodernism, but not necessarily to take the historical assumptions about the internal Torah logic and the fact that we're able to access it so easily, that of Rav Rosenzweig. And that is, it may be very simple. When the Rambam says, this is the halacha, so maybe we're not trying to understand what the Rambam was thinking, on one hand. We don't have to say like Rav Rosenzweig. I don't know, maybe the Rambam was a Brisker Lundus, but maybe he wasn't. I'm not sure if he had this particular conceptual idea in mind, number one. Number two, maybe I don't have to come on to the more postmodern idea that the text has a certain life in its own right, and then it goes beyond, it supersedes the intent of the author. Maybe I can avoid that as well. Maybe I can say that instead of learning the Rambam, and instead of saying that we're learning on some level ourselves, or the text at least is divorced from the Rambam, historical Rambam, maybe we can say the following, that we're not learning the Rambam per se, rather what we're learning is just Torah. What do I mean by that? We're learning Torah. Of course we're learning Torah, but it's not Chiddush. Rather, perhaps, once the Rambam, we know that there's an idea, as was mentioned, Eilu ve'eilu divrei Elokim chayim. Once the Rambam is a certain shita, whether we like it or not, or as other Rishonim agreed or disagreed, that becomes a chepsa shel Torah and a legitimate interpretation of the Ratzon Hashem. It's a chepsa shel Torah, it's part of the corpus of Talmud Torah. And perhaps, therefore, when we come to try to understand this particular psak of the Rambam, we don't have to attempt to understand the Rambam. All we're saying is that this is now part of the corpus of Torah. This is a psak. So therefore, we can ask ourselves, look, if this is part of the Ratzon Hashem, or this is a plausible interpretation of the Ratzon HaBore from a halachic perspective, perhaps we can then ask ourselves, so new, what is the underlying smara for that? So I know if the Rambam had this smara, I have no idea, but it's not relevant. What I'm trying to understand is, once this is a Chesed Shel Torah, what might be the underlying logic of this halacha? And it's not the Rambam, and it's not the text of the Rambam is divorced from the Rambam, but it's just halacha. So I say, we're learning Torah, we're learning the Ratzon Hashem. In which case, maybe we don't have to come on to any of this. Right? So that's basically a model. You could definitely develop that more fully. However, I should just grant that if you think about it, it's not going to explain it's not going to explain as much. Because according to what I'm saying, you'd have to, it'll be much more limited in its scope. I'll just give one example, and this will be the last point. Before we finally close, but just one example with Hanukkah. Sorry for going over, but just in terms of Hanukkah, so we know that the Rav had a whole vort. You might be familiar with it. The Rav wanted to know, why does the Rambam begin off with Hanukkah with a historical overview of the events of the Kashmonaim? Anyone know what the Rav answered? In short, what did the Rav answer? I think the Rav may have given different answers different times, which is also something you find. Well, at least at one point the Rav gave the answer that basically the idea is that part of the mitzvahs of Hanukkah include understanding the miracles. If you don't understand the events that happen in the story of Hanukkah, then you can't fully fulfill the mitzvahs all about. That's basically what the Rav suggested. There are other possible explanations, which might be simpler, others that suggested, probably more Pashtun answer, is just the Rambam basically was filling in anything you couldn't find through Tanakh. Right? Purim is where? It's in Tanakh. All the other Ma'adim are explained in Torah. Right? Hanukkah is the only one. So the Rambam basically, if you look at Tzarek, he's writing Mishnah Torah, basically you have Tanakh, but then this is Torah Sheval Pez. This is the summary of Torah Sheval Pez, Mishnah Torah, and therefore the Rambam wrote it. So there might be a more historical, as it were, or a different kind of explanation than that of the Rav. So now, if you think about it, this is a major difference, and nafka mina, I'll be a brisker for a minute, between my approach and that of Rosenzweig and Lichtenstein. Rosenzweig says the Rambam was a brisker. The Rambam was thinking in this kind of logic, and therefore, it makes sense according to Rosenzweig's understanding, so the Rav has said this. It's perfect. And according to Lichtenstein also. Maybe this isn't what the Rambam had in mind, but this is still, the Rambam's text as divorced from the Rambam's original intent. However, according to what I'm saying, just by example, I don't know if we could say the Rav's words anymore. Because the way I'm saying is that if the Rambam had a psach, that becomes a chetzo shel Torah. I'm not sure if you can say this idea, and this is a separate discussion, I'm not sure you can say that idea, maybe, but maybe not, about the fact that the Rambam introduced his halachos with the historical overview. So I just bring this as way as an example. Again, you could say a lot more, but just bring it out. I just wanted to close by with a passage that I put at the very end of the source sheet. This is by an article by Chaim Seaman. He wrote a fascinating piece, which you can find, I think, online, which is basically a comparison between Brisker Lumdus in the 19th century and 19th century analytic legal theory. He showed how there are very similar developments in the field of legal theory in the 19th century and in Halakha through Brisker Derech, which is fascinating. I think you can find that online. It's very interesting, but very long article. Lots of footnotes, but it's really interesting. And I think he brought out the idea that I think Rosenzweig was sort of getting at, and that I think cuts to the core of this issue and what the Brisker Derech, to some extent, is really all about. And he wrote, over its long history, legal thought has vacillated between two poles. One view is characterized by an extreme skepticism to the idea that law is an autonomous system. Here, law is little more than the assertion of power by those with enough clout and resources to manipulate the system accordingly. Doctrine is the tool used by the powerful to rule over the masses, and the law's complexity merely serves to mask the odium of raw politics by infusing it with the musky legitimacy of the law's alleged majesty. On the other end of the view of law is a timeless and elegant system of just principles. The law's mysterious austerity, ceremonial officiousness, and detailed rituals underscore that the system has its roots in the wisdom of the ages and in the eons of a distant past. The operative metaphors are reverence, stability, and tradition. Legal doctrine reflects the finest output of a particular history and tradition designed to ensure political and social harmony. And Chaim Seaman goes on to compare this to Brisk as well, that much of what Brisk was trying to do is to bring out the majestic beauty of Torah, the historicity of Torah, the reverence, stability, and tradition that he writes about here as well. And I think that's part of the struggle. How are we reflective and honest about what we're trying to do in the Brisker Derech, but always, to make sure that we continue to have that proper sense of reverence, the Yirato Kodemet Lachachmato, that Rav Rosenzweig had written about as well. Kol Tov, and everyone have a great day.